Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
At the end of the day, we're not looking for a war with China. We don't want a war with China. My belief is that, back to something Marshall asked about a moment ago, a very strong component in deterring both China and the United States from ending up in a war is a strong, capable, credible, forward-deployed U.S. military, particularly naval, given the geography of the circumstance.
This week, we are very excited to welcome Admiral James Stravitis. He spent more than 30 years in the U.S. Navy. He was a four-star admiral. He was the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. You might know him because he's frequently on cable news with Morning Joe. He has a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, where he also served as dean for 5 years.
We're speaking with the Admiral not merely because of his interest and deep knowledge on foreign policy, but specifically because he recently released a novel, 2034, a novel of the next world war that he co-authored with Elliot Ackerman, who is a writer who served in the Marine Corps in Iraq and Afghanistan. The book is incredibly interesting. The way that the Admiral describes it is it's not predictive fiction. So the idea isn't Elliot and I believe that X, Y, and Z thing will lead to a global conflict between the US and China. This is a cautionary tale of what could happen. What's very clear when we're speaking with the Admiral is not only his academic background, but the fact that he's a deeply read individual who takes a lot of inspiration from Cold War era novels and movies, such as Dr. Strangelove or others that really focused on what is the worst case scenario when these interstate conflicts during a Cold War go hot and go nuclear. So within all that context, the book was just really interesting. I blew through it in a weekend. It's also interesting because it's just far enough in the future that you can take a step out of the current political context and think about the deeper trends that are going on that are going to fuel any type of conflict like this.
Yeah, I really enjoy talking with the Admiral. And the thing is that you guys don't even probably know this, but Marshall and I's first love really is foreign policy. He's not only somebody who served in the military, and trust me, that's not necessarily a prerequisite for being interesting, but he's somebody who actually has thought deeply about the current international system. The Admiral is very into World War I. He sees a changing balance of power. He uses the word realignment a lot, so thank you for that, Admiral. But most importantly, I think, is this. When you have somebody who served at the very top of the U.S. military saying that a change is happening and that escalation of all different types is possible, I think it's important both to dialogue and to listen to that person and also read their book because it's descriptive of what exactly something might look like. I think your guys are going to get a lot out of this episode.
And a special Easter egg for those of you who consistently ask us about third parties. It should be noted, we will not give away spoilers for the book, but it should be noted the president in 2034 comes from neither party. So of course we had to ask the Admiral about it, and he gave a really interesting answer coming from the perspective of a centrist who was vetted to be Hillary Clinton's VP, but also received an offer to join the Trump administration. So he's able to look at it from the perspective of someone who truly is in the middle of all of this. So this is a special episode for us to talk about our bookshop. The Admiral and his co-author actually discuss a bunch of books that inspired them. So we specifically wanted to put together a special section of our bookshop shop where you will see the recommendations, everything from On China by Henry Kissinger to The Three Body Problem to Starship Troopers. Everything there. There's a lot of really great books there. We're really blown away by how many people have been purchasing books and sharing in our section. So when you go to our bookshop, it's right next to the Lex Fridman Show example.
Yeah, that's right. I've just been stunned at the interest there ever since I was on Lex's show. And even, you know, since then, and how many of you guys are interested not only in books on politics and history, but life and everything. So we've got you guys covered. And remember, if you purchase from our bookshop, it helps both an independent bookstore during COVID-19 and it helps the show here. So we would really appreciate it if you guys went there. With that, let's get to the question and answer period.
The This is on Apple Podcasts from Kyle from New Jersey. Hey guys, love the show. You have a lot of folks from media, tech, business, and politics, but I feel like a major source of power is missed by yourselves and many others, in that there's a lack of interviews with those who are in the national defense field. I'm thinking of General Petraeus, Admiral McRaven, General McChrystal, etc. One thing I wonder is, with all the talk about competition with China, the US still retains an asymmetrically more powerful military. Therefore, how do you think the US wields this advantage in competition with China going into the future? Obviously, the pitfalls are severe, but it's naive to think the US won't press this advantage while it still exists, both conventional and unconventional. So what's interesting, and this is why the book is so useful, is the Admiral and his co-author are thinking really deeply about ways that this advantage we have, aka we have the most aircraft carriers in the world, we have everything from the F-35 fighter plane to the F-22 Raptor, these very advanced weapons platforms that have really come out of this era where we were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, where there was no question that the US was the most powerful military on the battlefield. Once again, without getting into too many spoilers, something the Admiral is deeply interested in is the idea that there are ways that foes of the United States, whether they're China, whether they're Iran, whether they're the Russians, can actually use these advantages we have against us. So, for example, using cyber capability to hack the advanced weapons platforms such as the F-35, using missiles to sink carriers, which are our primary advantage that we've really built up on in the Pacific region. So it's really interesting how we could think about, and if you're thinking about this book and this interview, how are these advantages we've held for a long time capable of being undermined in asymmetric ways that any rising power could think about?
I love that part of the book, and I actually think it's one of the most important parts, which is that don't presume that our advantage in technological warfare will be our savior. And most importantly, though, is I think I take your question to heart because you're right. It is very difficult. Marshall has actually interviewed some of the people that you mentioned there on the list, and what we want to do here on this podcast is bring something to you, which is an actual, honest discussion about where we're headed, about time in office, and more. Which is much more difficult than you might think whenever it comes to interviewing people in the military. So I would take away this episode as both a response to a very clear demand that we had there. You're not the first person to ask, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate the work they let us do here. Let's dive in.
Admiral Stavridis, welcome to The Realignment.
Terrific to be with both of you.
Good to see you, sir.
Let's dive into it. Loved the book, blew through it over the weekend. It is a definitely scary, but also really exciting read. In the end of the book, you have at least the Audible version, you have an interview with a person at the publishing house, and you're discussing that this book itself is a warning, much in the way that in the 1960s and 1950s, you had warnings of what could go wrong in the U.S.-Soviet Cold War. What is the warning that you are expressing in 2034?
Yeah, as I always say, 2034, a novel of the next world war, is not predictive fiction. It is cautionary fiction. It's a cautionary tale, much like Dr. Strangelove or Failsafe or The Bedford Incident or The Third World War by Sir John Hackett. The idea is to imagine your way into the future, to look at how terrible a war with China could be, how we could stumble into it, truly sleepwalk into it in a scenario in which neither nation is looking for a significant conflagration, and number three, how difficult it is to control the ladder of escalation once an incident begins.
One of the things I really appreciate about your work, Admiral, which is that the willingness to engage very much in the past and then rooting this book in a caution, but with a mindfulness of where things have come. So let's talk about kind of how the international system itself has changed to the point where a 2034 conflict like you describe in the book can even occur. I mean, we had this entire period. You were in the military for this, the 1990s, the peace dividend, America supreme. These were just living in a fundamentally different reality. So both in terms of your career and now where you see where things are headed, talk about the global realignment happening that even makes great power competition and the outbreak of war a very real possibility in 2034.
Yeah, I think by 2034, your podcast will really be all there. The realignment will be here. And we are, frankly, at the leading edge of the big realignment for this part of the century. And I think it's going to be pretty obviously the rise of China to appear in every sense with the United States, economically, global military deployments, capability in cyber, influence throughout much of the world. We haven't had that. We, the United States, have not faced that scenario, as you correctly point out, since back in the days of the Cold War. And people ask me sometimes, well, are we in a Cold War with China? And I, you know, I'm with Henry Kissinger on this. We're in the foothills of a Cold War, but we are continuing to ascend the mountain. And I fear the reality is that 10 to 15 years from now, when 2034, the novel is set, we will be in a Cold War, certain. And our mission then will be to avoid it turning into a hot war. Luckily, we completed that mission during the Cold War. But boy, did we come close. Cuban Missile Crisis being perhaps the peak moment of danger. Could that happen again? US, China, 10 to 15 years from now? Unfortunately, I think it is all too real a possibility.
And speaking of missions, our mission is to sell books, so we're not going to give too many spoilers. But a question based on the book itself, I want you to talk about the lessons that specifically come from the book. Because from my perspective, the predictive model you've taken, not the predictive, but the cautionary model you've taken could offer different lessons for different ideological groups. So, for example, there is a major conflict in the book around Taiwan specifically. Now, one could say, hey, we need to not appease. We need to stay firm with our allies. We need to be clear about American intentions. That could be one version of the lesson. The other version of a lesson, a more isolationist version, could be, okay, great. The admiral's correct. We shouldn't be risking American blood and treasure in this, in Chinese Taipei. Let them have it. So how do you think about that takeaways from an ideological perspective?
First and foremost, there's a tactical takeaway, which is regardless of what you think we ought to be doing, these two nations operating in close proximity with powerful militaries can cause a spark to erupt. That's takeaway number one, is the danger of miscalculation. Takeaway number two, my view, would be to deal with the rise of China, you need a strategy, you need a plan, and it has to incorporate all the elements of national power to include a very capable U.S. military, because through strength, you create deterrence. I think another takeaway is cyber. Prepare for cyber attacks, prepare for them to occur at scale. Learn how to protect in cyberspace. I would argue create a cyber force, just as we recently created a space force. Smart move. We need a cyber force. And so the world of cyber is a second set of takeaways. Number three, you'll notice in the book, the U.S. is operating in an environment with very few allies. You really don't see NATO in the book. You really don't see Japan in the book. Again, we don't want to give the content away, but I think part of the cautionary tale is in 15 years, how have we arrived at this point where we're involved in a confrontation with China, yet we really don't see this network of allies, partners, and friends? The takeaway for me, as someone who values deeply that network, is you've got to tend that garden. You've got to continue to nurture it, because what we don't want to be in 10 to 15 years is, you know, alone and unafraid steaming through the South China Sea with our destroyers, which is exactly how the book opens. So there's three quick takeaways, but I agree with you. You can interpret it differently, and I hope that's the power of the book. And that's partly why I did it as fiction and created a novel. It's more approachable. I hope it sparks conversation. You're not in the straitjacket of fact that you are when you write nonfiction policy papers. And I hope it sparks the exact kind of conversation that you alluded to a moment ago, Marshall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just want to follow up on the comment around allies, because it also goes to a very present dynamic one, which is interesting, which is China's neighbors itself. So you obviously have conflicts in the South China Sea. You have Vietnam. That's an interesting things parry and realign around the US's relationship with the world. But you have Vietnam, you have the Philippines, you have Japan. You have these other parts of the Asia Pacific, Indo-Pacific region that are also operating as well. How do you think the current state of those relationships are in a way that, because obviously there's a discussion around allies, NATO especially, but I think the context around Vietnam and those other countries are a little different.
It is. And I think that if you live in that neighborhood of the Western Pacific to us or East Asia, if you live in that neighborhood, you've got to be worried about China. You've got to be worried about what you're seeing. And starting with Vietnam, right there next to them on the South China Sea, but also the Philippines, Thailand, South Korea, Japan is in a significant dispute with China about the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, Taiwan, Australia, New Zealand, everybody in the neighborhood is quite worried. And as a result, it's an opportunity for the United States in today's context to work more closely with them. And here we bring in another significant character in the novel, which is India. And I think many readers will be surprised at the role India ends up playing in this novel. In today's world, in the real world, the so-called Quad alignment is a brand new realignment to again, flog your podcast.
He said it again. Yes.
And it's a realignment that India, which has traditionally been non-aligned between the West and totalitarian countries during the Cold War, certainly led the non-aligned movement during the Cold War. Yet today, in real terms, we're seeing India drawing closer and closer to the United States, Australia, Japan, and India. Those four constitute what is now called the Quad. I think that's a significant geopolitical realignment that's happening in front of us in real life. And it may or may not reflect how events unfold in 2034, because India will have a mind of its own. It will be a great power in this century before the clock spins to 2100.
Some of our Indian fans are doing backflips around that, Admiral. I've been waiting for somebody to say it.
Hey, I think honestly, it's let me make a comment I say all the time, which is 300 years from now, when a historian sits down to write the history of this century, it will not be about the rise of China because of demographics. It will be about the rise of India, demographically powerful, already a democracy, and a nation that has linkages to the West, English as a lingua franca. My money's on India by the end of this century.
That's a whole other podcast in itself. You know, it's fascinating. I'm realizing, just to bring another realignment angle into this, is that Marshall and I very much came of age, or especially international relations with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is, in many ways, almost like a reaction on the other side of military thinking. Now, you're a Navy man, and the Navy was largely an afterthought, you know, during many of those, not rightfully so. One of the things that I actually would love to hear from you is how this global realignment, the rise of peer competition with China and more, kind of challenges basic precepts of the American Navy. So I'm talking there about what a blue water Navy is. What fundamentally does the world and the possibility of conflict look like when American naval supremacy is diminished, or at the very least even challenged, which you see slightly right now, but not to the extent, I think, which leads to the scenario which you talk about in your book. I just think these are concepts we haven't grappled with since, I mean, almost the age of Theodore Roosevelt, when we were becoming a global power. Can you articulate that a little bit for the audience?
I can, but first I've got to at least say a word about the Navy's role in the global war on terror, which was quite profound. Our carrier strike groups were conducting long-range, constant bombardments in Iraq, Afghanistan. I commanded the carrier Enterprise as part of my strike group. We did thousands of missions. The Navy SEALs were deeply prominent, including leading the raid that killed bin Laden, et cetera, et cetera. Just can't let you quite get away with the Navy as an afterthought. I say that with a smile on my face. So let's talk about the world going forward. I think you are absolutely correct. We are going to re-engage on these questions of what does it mean to be a global Navy when we are challenged? And by the way, here we come on to the role of Russia, which has a very capable Navy. And in the novel 2034, China and Russia have drawn closer and closer together and are largely in alignment. We're seeing that play out in real terms right now. So it's really not just a global Chinese Navy. It will probably be a Chinese-Russian combined Navy. That's a pretty significant force. And already China has more combatant warships than the United States does. Ours are bigger. They can deploy further. We have nuclear power. We have many more aircraft carriers. But China is rising and building a significant fleet. And when you put that alongside the Russian fleet, which is particularly powerful in nuclear-powered submarines, it's a formidable force. And not just in the Northern Pacific. We see deployments today to the North Atlantic, to the Arctic, to the Baltic Sea by joint Russian-Chinese flotillas operating very capably together. So this is coming, and here's what it means. It means the United States has got to increase the size of its Navy, in my view. And this is something that both the end of the Obama administration and the Trump administration, in fact, agreed upon, was the idea of increasing the size of the Navy to a minimum of 355 ships. We're parked right around 300 right now. But I would argue it means taking that blue water Navy, dialing down some of the emphasis on those beloved aircraft carriers, which are also massive targets, and doing more from the sea with unmanned vehicles in the air, on the surface, subsurface, more offensive cyber operations, more movement behind those island chains close to China with our Navy SEALs and with our Marine Raiders. All of that is a kind of a new strategic triad of unmanned cyber special forces that I think are going to be immensely important if we end up in a war with China. And I'll close by saying, at the end of the day, we're not looking for a war with China. We don't want a war with China. My belief is that, back to something Marshall asked about a moment ago, a very strong component in deterring both China and the United States from ending up in a war is a strong, capable, credible, forward-deployed U.S. military, particularly naval, given the geography of the circumstance.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to build on Sagar's accidental besmirching of the U.S. Navy by just giving a little more context in all fairness, which is we're really looking at this as two guys who were fourth graders during 9/11. And as we're thinking about the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, you're thinking about a specific type of warfare. So in Afghanistan, you're thinking, actually in both countries, you're thinking counterinsurgency, very infantry centric. If anything, the tanks were not even relevant to the Afghanistan war. Much more different in Iraq, obviously, the debates over the surge, all that different context. The Army and Marine Corps have to pivot to mine-resistant vehicles in a way that wasn't necessarily planned for post-Cold War, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how much is this book and the world you're describing a response to the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan and their legacy? Because something, once again, without spoilers, that I'll note is Afghanistan and Iraq, other than from a biographical perspective within the characters, don't really come up. Not that they're quite necessary, but more of it's just not built out in the world. So can you talk about, can you just bring Iraq and Afghanistan into the framework of the book then?
Iraq and Afghanistan at this point are in the rearview mirror. And I think that's going to be true 10 to 15 years from now. Doesn't mean they're going to be ungoverned spaces run by terrorist organizations. I don't think they will. I think both Iraq and Afghanistan have a reasonable, call it a 2 in 3 chance of maintaining themselves as, in the context of the region, relatively stable democracies. I think there's a 1 in 3 chance in both countries that the wheels could come off. But I think what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan has at least given both countries an opportunity to seize their own future. And so I think they will seize that future and go forward. Time will tell. That's not what 2034 is about. 2034 is about looking ahead. And here, I think the most recent germane period is probably pre-World War II for the United States. It is when the Japanese Empire is expanding throughout Asia, East Asian co-prosperity sphere, geoeconomic, ding, ding, ding. What does that sound like? How about One Belt, One Road? Using political pressure in the context of that geoeconomic strategy, mercantile strategy, highly dependent on a continuous flow of what? Raw materials. Mm-hmm. Why do you think China wants the South China Sea? It's not only, it's a crossroads, but more importantly, it's full of hydrocarbons. That's what they want. And that's why are they drawing closer to Russia? When China looks north, they see a vast, empty land called Siberia. It's the size of the continental United States, and less than 20 million Russians live there. It's full of oil, gas, timber, arable land, fresh water, rare earths, diamonds. It looks to the Chinese the way a ribeye steak looks to my dog. It looks really good. So what we see happening as 2034 unfolds is an assertive China, one that has created a kind of partnership, albeit Russia is the junior partner. And by the way, and I think this also is happening before our eyes, Iran, which today is a young, dynamic nation with an imperial ambition, parked where? Right next to India. And One Belt, One Road has one big problem. And the big problem is India, because India geographically is right in the center of the putative One Belt, One Road. So if you're not going to get along with India and you're China, you're probably going to build strong relations with who? Pakistan and Iran, because they're the two big dogs in the neighborhood after India, the South Asian neighborhood.
So two questions. First is a definitional one. Can you just explain what One Belt, One Road actually is?
Mm-hmm. One Belt, One Road is a Chinese strategy. It's a very smart one that seeks to create a belt and a road across Asia from China on the old Marco Polo Silk Road that runs into Europe. That's one belt or road. And down below is a maritime belt or road that runs from the South China Sea through the Strait of Malacca across the vast Indian Ocean to Africa on the south, Arabia on the north, and also onto Europe. And the idea of One Belt, One Road is that China will exert political and economic influence along those two paths, which cover, half of the world's land surfaces between Africa, Europe, and Asia, two-thirds. And they are going to export raw materials along that path, along that Belt and Road, and they will import raw materials. And all of that is designed to ensure growth for China, because what the Chinese leadership has to do to remain in power, because they're an authoritarian government, they have to please the people so that the natural tendency of humans to seek democracy, to seek liberty, can be better suppressed in an environment where people have a full belly, where people are emerging into a middle-class life. One Belt, One Road is a clever strategy, and it marries together capitalism with authoritarian rule. And it is going to be a challenge for the United States in all the dimensions we've talked about this afternoon.
And one thing I'm just curious about, given your articulation of why Russia and China would come together, to me it seems like almost the opposite would be true in the sense that Russia is a declining power. It's not just that there are 20 million Russians in Siberia. It's that the population is declining. Mortality, especially among military age males, is going up due to a variety of civilizational decline issues. So why wouldn't China leverage, why would China enter into a partnership? Why wouldn't China just be more aggressive with territorial claims in Siberia? I'm curious why you just think that leads. And then I'm also struggling to think of a time when Russia's been complacent with being a junior to basically anyone.
It's true.
First, your advice is smart. And if Vladimir Putin were a better strategist, he would take your advice, because Russia's future, its best future, doesn't lie to the south with China, because inevitably it will end up a junior partner. Russia's better future lies to the west with Europe, connecting with Europe, Nord Stream 2, the pipeline. If the question is why would Russia enter into this kind of condominium, it is because they have no other good options, because Putin has boxed them out of working with Europe by invading Ukraine, supporting a war criminal Assad, his cyber attacks on democracies, both here in the United States and in Europe. There's no good option for him in Europe at this point. And he looks at China as a fellow authoritarian state. That's really the key to understanding why these two nations will come together. And believe me, you're correct. Russia won't view it as a junior partnership. But over time, because of the demographic points you're making, I think that's where it will end up.
It's interesting, Admiral, as I'm listening and we were looking at the book, was that the sleepwalking element of sleepwalking into conflict is very much present, which is, of course, a key theme of World War One, something I'm kind of obsessed with. And how much did you rely on and think about those balance of power, elements during World War One, and what analogies can we draw from that as we enter a new age of peer competition? Because the Cold War framework, it just doesn't quite fit. I mean, at the end of the day, yes, Russia was a global power, and yes, the Warsaw Pact and all of that, but just China is just exponentially more of a peer on so many different cultural, economic, and other levels that it really does almost feel like a Germany to a United Kingdom, like both strong powers in their own rights in different respects that actually would be going at it and could end up in a devastating war. Could you talk about that dynamic here?
I can, and I'll do it in the context of two books, both of which you'll know. One is Graham Allison's The Thucydides Trap.
Right.
Can America and China avoid the Thucydides Trap? The actual title, I think, is Destined for War. Mm-hmm. By the way, there's not a question mark at the end of the title. And what Graham does, Professor Allison, mentor of mine for decades, he goes back through history, back to the ancient Greeks. I know this part is true because I'm Greek American. And he looks at, I think it's 16 or 18 different cases in global history in which an established power, Athens, challenged by a rising power, Sparta. It happens again and again in human history. Most recently, just over 100 years ago, your point, established power, United Kingdom, rising power, Kaiser's Germany. In two-thirds of the cases, just over two-thirds of the cases, a global war ensues. Again, most recently, World War One. So I think what we are seeing is, I agree with you, not the Cold War, which was an ideological conflict in many ways. This is not. This is straight stick, good old fashioned geopolitics, which is to say, established power, United States, challenged by rising power. So yes, we ought to look very coherently at World War One. Here are the book that was rattling around in my head, and I'm sure you've read it if you're a World War One aficionado, would be, of course, The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman, possibly the best pure writer in terms of laying out a narrative history, although there are some challengers for that. But The Guns of August, she followed up with a lesser known book also by Barbara Tuchman, The March of Folly, about how the United States managed to stumble into Vietnam, is kind of the centerpiece of that book. I think the correct thing to do is look not only at Great Britain, Kaiser's Germany. We need to look at the historical examples that Graham Allison provides us with and think very consciously about this idea of a Thucydides trap, because it is a trap, but we can still avoid it. Again, that's why I wrote the book, to highlight the chances that we don't escape the trap.
Yeah, you're really taking me back to my my IR days at Georgetown, sir, so I appreciate it.
Why didn't you go to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy? You could have been a rock star in D.C.
It's the only good part-time foreign policy program in D.C.
Exactly. But, you know, just to pick up on that, because I think this is an important element, which is shared history. This is something that we've written about, which is that and not just from the power standpoint of when you have two powers that are rising here, but is there something within the narratives of these two nations and of the Chinese Communist Party in particular, which does, I wouldn't say destined for war, because as we learned with World War One, which is that discrete decisions can have actually outsized impacts on the eventual impact of the war and more. But is there, are we destined for conflict in some form simply because of our shared historical internal narratives?
I don't think there's an inevitability to that. Some would disagree with that, and I think you can make a coherent case again. Graham Allison lays it out pretty specifically in the book. I think we can avoid it for several reasons. One is, at least at the moment, this is non-ideological. As much as we would love to see China become a democracy, we're not in any sense seeking to change the regime, to convert them to democracy. This is not John F. Kennedy, we will bear any burden in the cause of democracy. We're okay with China having an authoritarian, totalitarian government. We will call them out on specific instances of gross violations of human rights, Uyghurs, treatment of individuals in Hong Kong. But fundamentally, we're not trying to change their system, and they're not trying to change ours. They are not. I do not feel that. Whereas during the Cold War, it was an ideological conflict. Second reason I think we have a chance of avoiding this, geography. At the end of the day, unlike the Cold War, where effectively with NATO, we shared a common border with the Soviet Union, today we don't with China. There's a geographical separation that I think is somewhat salutary to us here. And then thirdly, the pie is just bigger. The global pie is bigger here. And as long as we can continue to maintain global growth, it'll continue to get bigger. So is there therefore room for China and the US to both be investing in Ethiopia as it comes out of a civil war, in Latin America? Yes. We don't have that same pre-World War I scramble for colonies and dividing the world as a kind of economic imperative. It's a much bigger world now. So I think those are three things that give me some hope that we can avoid a war with China. And I'll add a fourth, which again is kind of highlighted in the book, and we've chatted about it already. It's the rise of India. Because it's a democracy, it's not going to, my view, end up aligned with China. And it just creates a much harder path for China to try and achieve some kind of true global dominance. I don't think India will be sanguine about that role for China, and therefore there's openings for the U.S. I think that will help balance China. And actually, I'll add a fifth and final one, which is China is not 10 feet tall. You know, China has many challenges, including its own demographics, which are declining, a gender misbalance that is profound and significant, many more women than men because of the one-child policy. They have environmental catastrophe across much of their nation that will need remediation. They don't have the network of allies, partners, and friends that we do, although as we've discussed, they're going to try to build that as part of One Belt, One Road. And in my view, above all, they're not a democracy. And although democracy is messy and difficult, you know, I'm with Churchill, it's the worst form of government, except for all the others. China is going to have internal pressures that are going to be working on them. And God knows we have them here. But we have a safety valve that's called democracy that allows us, if we use it intelligently, to release some of that internal tension. When China's moment of internal tension comes, there's no safety valve. That's when countries blow up. That's what led to the French Revolution, for example. No safety valve.
So that's the perfect pivot to my last question. Then we'll get one last question to follow up on your book suggestions. In the book, speaking of politics, the president of the United States does not come from an established party. Correct. And it's remarked upon on the Chinese side of things that the lack of support from the traditional two-party system and the bipartisan consensus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is an important reality in the world they're all living in. I enjoyed in the book interview, you specifically stated that you're actually credentialed to be a centrist and that you were vetted to be a VP for Secretary Clinton, but you also were offered a role in the Trump administration. So you actually can claim something in the center of our political system. How in this last section do you think the current realignment era political tumult plays into these international affairs questions?
Clearly, the two-party system is under pressure in the United States. And I look at millennials, my children are in their late 20s, and they look at both political parties and just shake their heads. And the acrimony and the way both of these political parties are coming to be dominated by far left and far right doesn't bode well. And I think a lot of Americans kind of assume, well, we just got to live with that, you know, and they think somewhere in the Constitution, you know, Article XX, it says there shall be two political parties. One shall be called Republican, the other shall be called Democrat. Hey, that's not our history. We started with Whigs, Federalists, Nationalists. Eventually we get a Republicans, Democrats, you know, and they have solidified control. But 100 years ago, the Progressive Party, by the way, wasn't the progressives of the squad on the Hill. The Progressive Party was Teddy Roosevelt's center-right Republican Party. My point is, there's room for another political movement, maybe a non-aligned movement, maybe a new political party. Who knows? But I don't think we're static in that regard. And I'd say, you know, 10 to 15 years from now, if the two current parties cannot get their act together, find their way back to cooperating with each other, elect leaders who want to reach across the aisle and solve problems, if they can't get to that, I think the American voters are going to start looking elsewhere.
So, Admiral, you mentioned Destined for War. In Wired, you actually recommended a couple other books, two of which we picked out were The Three-Body Problem. I have it right behind me here. And then On China by Secretary Kissinger. Can you just offer a quick summation of why you chose those two books?
Well, The Three-Body Problem is actually part of a trilogy, as you well know, that imagines its way into an extremely distinct future, with many backstories, many bolt holes through the plot and narrative. And I just loved the portrait of China that emerges from it, which is distinct from what we have talked about on this podcast today. It's a remarkable work of imagination and really science fiction. In terms of On China, there's no better book in terms of one-stop shopping. And Henry Kissinger, may he live forever, is without question the greatest political sinologist we have produced in this nation. He was present at the creation of the new relationship, opening China over 50 years ago, well over 50 years ago. And here he is at the far end of that journey, helping advise us, I think, coherently about how to avoid a war in 2034. Those are, I think, yes, two very good books, and I picked them for Kissinger, depth of knowledge and firsthand experience, Three-Body Problem, because it's a Chinese story of science fiction.
Well, we highly recommend both. We really appreciate you joining us, sir, and we're very appreciative of your time. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Marsh, once a year.
Absolutely. You. See you, sir. Thanks for listening to the episode, guys. We really appreciate it. Just as a special reminder, make sure you check out our bookshop, which will include links to both Admiral Stavridis's recommended books and our recommended books, bookshop.org, link in the show notes. Also, make sure you give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Really helps other people find the show. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate it, and we will see you all next week.